Hey, Chris, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to ask you a set of rapid-fire questions. The first
Absolutely.
one, I have for you is, what would you do if you had the opportunity to be the governor for a couple of days?
For a couple of days. Well, I was thinking when you said rapid fire, you said a couple of days. I was like, oh, I'm gonna get to do like one thing, but I've got like a whole like 48 hours. I think a big focus, something that's been missed in North Carolina for a long time, is we've got to look at social justice equity reform at this point. We've got to look at criminal justice reform. We've got to look at the citizens that we've been treating like criminals for too long in this state and finally kind of bring them out of the dark where they've been dying and give them a chance to grow in the light. So that would definitely be some things that I would love to do. And of course, pardon as many cannabis prisoners as I can for low-level possession charges. There's a couple other things that I could think of that I could say, but they would be too personal against certain members of the NCGA. So I'll keep those comments to myself.
Okay. Fair enough. How would you define the role of a lobbyist in one sentence?
Similar to a closer.
And would you like to expand on that a little bit?
And what I mean by that is because a closer has some negative connotations to it sometimes. I come from a sales background. I come from a performance background. Everything that I've learned about the industry that I'm in now, I learned from being part of the legal industry at a much younger age than most people. But I took all of those experiences that I had along the way and am able to kind of, create them into what I have now that allows me to get the results that I've been getting. When I say closer, it's a lobbyist is someone who's keeping the conversation going. They're the in-between person that you need that can connect to the representative they're talking to, that knows enough about, the pomp and circumstance and policy and procedure that goes on inside those hallowed halls. You need someone that can walk that line between just being edgy enough to keep people on their toes, but not disrespectful in any way, shape, or form that might keep them out of getting into some people's offices down the road. It's you've got to really know how to play the game, as they used to say it in the day. You've got to really know how to play that game, and you've got to be able to. It's not about beating the other person when it comes to debate or conversations. I've never believed that. I'm not in this to win and someone has to lose. I'm in this to educate someone who may have been misinformed. My goal is I want to go in similar with the attitude of a closer in a high-end sales type situation where, it's life or death. Someone's got to win, someone's got to lose. Yes, you want that passion, you want that drive, but you want your overall motivation when it comes to being a closer in this context to be more about giving the other person on the side of the table the education they need to change their mind on their own because you opened their eyes.
Well said. What excites you more, policy or politics?
I would have to say politics.
And why is that?
I enjoy the dance. To put it, as simply as I can think of, I enjoy the dance. I love conversation. I love being able to connect to someone, even if it's just for a moment. I love the challenge of going in knowing that someone doesn't want to listen to what I'm saying, but being able to find a way to connect with them on a humanity level to where they're still intrigued by the person standing in front of them enough to hear them out where they might not want to listen to someone else talking about the same topic. So that's, I would have to go with politics for that reason. I just love the interaction between it. It can get addictive. I was just in the House in the NCGA yesterday representing the new hemp regulation bill. And when it passed committee, it's the same thing. I just you stand up and you feel good, that all the work that you've done for the past 3 months, all the relationships you've formed, the late night sitting at home, basically writing policy and writing a bill for the representative that's behind the bill because they just don't know enough about the topic to write all of it themselves, to be able to be used as a resource like that, where they're like, we know that you have the knowledge we need to put on paper. We're the ones that can put it on paper. So just email me everything that you need me to type up. And it's really nice to get those kind of, those have those conversations and get those emails because you start feeling recognized for your efforts.
Nice. Do you have any role models in your life?
I mean, I've had a number of people that I've looked up to over the years. As far as any immediate role models, I've always I always looked up to my grandfather for everything that he went through. Just being able to completely have to switch careers in the middle of a depression and still be able to make it to the point where I don't know how he did it, but he also managed to help take care of the other people in the neighborhood around him, where when I was growing up as a child, we would have family dinners, Christmas, Thanksgiving. The house there in Virginia was always filled with at least to about 30 or 35 people. And I just always assumed as a child that we were related to them. And it wasn't until I got to be of an older age and that generation started passing away, we would go to funerals and I would be introduced to them as, they wouldn't call them Uncle so-and-so anymore. Like they would say, oh, this is, you know, Mike Robinson. He knew your grandfather because of this. So it was like, I finally started realizing that all these people that we'd had around us that I thought were family were people that my grandfather had helped by using his experience in insurance and investment and small business to survive the depression and not have to leave that neighborhood that they'd all grown up in. So he really did, you know, use a lot of the resources he had and a lot of the knowledge he had from past, you know, different business experiences and cultivated kind of like, you know, a consulting service that no one had thought of at that point. He just wanted to save his neighborhood, you know, and I'd always looked up to the respect and the admiration that people still gave him, you know, all these years later, where they weren't just clients to him, they became family, you know, and that's kind of probably the biggest role model in that example I've ever had is, you know, I don't want the people I work with to ever feel like it's just about the money that I'm getting or about, you know, just making sure that the bill that we need to pass or that passes, you know, I'm very particular about who I work with for a reason. You know, I don't want to ever have to represent a company that would force me to shift my moral compass in a direction that I'm not willing to do. So I'm very particular about that. And I'm very proud with the people that I'm representing now. Delta 9 Analytical and Vortex Sales Group have done amazing jobs in North Carolina for moving cannabis legislation forward, and also had a crucial role to play in House Bill 563, the most recent hemp bill that passed, the one that regulates the hemp industry and kratom industry now.
That is an amazing story about your grandfather. Thanks for sharing it. What is the best advice you ever received?
Don't underestimate your own experience. Hmm. And it was coming from the industry that I did and getting into that same industry in a legal light 30 years past my first introduction to it, you know, that's a big gap in a resume that you can't, I couldn't go to a lot of these companies in Colorado and California and then Florida that were legalizing cannabis, that were setting up grow operations, where I could take the knowledge that I have of genetics, all the time that I've spent with the knowledge I have of different type of like soil procedures when it comes to setting up irrigation. You know, I have a wealth of knowledge in a number of different facets in the industry, but it's all from the black market. And so I can't just, even though I'm talking with a cannabis company, I still have to realize it's a company. I can't turn in a resume to a company for a job I'm expecting to get when I'm admitting to like 8 different felonies on the first page. You know, it's really nerve-wracking. Because you still have to be proud of that experience, though. And the best advice I was ever given was by someone who managed to make it despite their time in the, you know, black market industry and, you know, 2 felonies that they accrued during that time in the industry. You know, they were able to get their record exonerated. They were able to create their own business. They were able to grow that to the point where they were bringing in partners that helped push him past a lot of the, you know, still gray areas on his background check that would pop up when they were trying to make bigger moves and things like that. You know, they got them certain DEA certifications that they never thought they would get. It's a lot. You've got to remember that everything happens for a reason. And while my background is more varied than a lot of others, I still feel that everything I've done plays a crucial role in where I am now. And just to give you a weird example of what I mean by that, everything to me is circular in all I do. When I was 15 years old, I lived in the Outer Banks of North Carolina in Hatteras Village. And my mother was involved through business and accounting with someone named Bob DeGabriel, who owned a real estate company at the time called Bob DeGabriel and Associates. They built a lot of the larger beach mansions that you see when, you know, you look at your more iconic pictures of like the Outer Banks, as far as Avon, Buxton, Hatteras, Nag's Head, places like that. And this was the height of that building craze that went on. So he was a very well-known man in the village. And come to find out, now that I start lobbying for cannabis legalization in North Carolina, almost 30 years later, that same person, Bob DeGabriel, I find out left Bob DeGabriel and Associates and went out to California and Oklahoma and started Solis Farms and was named like one of the top 10 entrepreneurs in Cannabis Business Times magazine for like 3 years in a row. And we've reconnected recently. We've been able to like talk, and he's recently sold the farm, and I think he's thinking about retiring now, but just he was he couldn't believe to speak to me and realize the industry that I was in now and the industry that he has, you know, managed to cultivate for himself, because I didn't even know at that time that cannabis was something that he was into. And I'm not about to go up to him at the age that I was and admit to knowing anything about cannabis. But it was very unique to find out down the road that someone that I had numerous interactions with as a child, that I took business advice from as a teenager, you know, someone who's I've been to dinner with before, I've been to his house to see his family, all of a sudden, here he is, an icon in an industry that I didn't even know he was a part of until I started lobbying for it in my own state. So, I mean, that's the best advice I can ever think to give anyone, is never look at anything as circumstance, and you have to get creative sometimes, but there's always a lesson that can be learned from every experience you have that you can turn into success in whatever your chosen field is.
Nice. That's like, it's like the whole circle came around. What are you thankful for?
I'm thankful for the understanding of my family more than anything. I could not do this without the people that I have in my corner being forgiving about flexible schedules, you know, putting up with annoying phone calls at 9 o'clock at night that, you know, I have to put on speakerphone because I need to pace when I talk because it makes me think quicker. All those late nights of me trying to figure out policy in a state that I don't even live in, you know, to figure out how to win an argument in a case that has nothing to do with us and isn't going to pay our rent, isn't going to make my car payment, isn't going to keep the lights on, but it could lead to money 5-10 years down the road. The understanding and the belief and the faith that it takes to have with what I've created for myself, because there was no guidebook for any of this. I don't have a political science degree. I don't have anything in my background like running for, you know, local, state, federal office, none of that. I'm not a lawyer. I've never worked in a law firm. A lot of the things that you would expect someone to have, I've never even temped with a, you know, consulting firm or a lobbyist firm. I'm just someone who has a unique ability to be able to connect to people. And when I talk on a topic that I am passionate about, for some reason, people like to listen. And that's something that I've always held with a lot of responsibility. I know my words can reach a number of people, and I know that they have power. And I always want to be humble about that. You know, there are arguments that I never thought that I would have won, and people's minds that I never thought that I would have changed. And there are times where I know that that type of ability could be used for evil. And I try to make sure that the decisions I'm making every day are the decisions that keep that same moral compass I spoke about earlier, you know, always pointing true north.
And going back to a little bit into your past, where did you grow up, and you know, what was your childhood like? And you told us like you didn't get any degree in political science. Talk us through that phase.
So my childhood was riddled with a lot of unfortunate moments, not by anyone's fault, because I learned at a very young age to blame the disease and not the man. My father was a highly decorated Army specialist in Vietnam, three tours that he gladly signed up for. He regrets them now, but at the time, you know, he had a job and a service to his country, and I respect him for that. It left him the shell of the man that he was, and growing up with someone suffering from severe PTSD and alcoholism is not the easiest childhood to endure. But again, we had the support group of our church. My mother stood by him the whole time. I would like to say that the VA stepped in when they could to help us, but the VA was as big a part of the nightmare that was my childhood, unfortunately, the same as my father's PTSD attacks and alcoholism. I am proud to say that he is been sober for more years than I can remember now. And he is someone that I love with all of my heart. And again, I blame the man. I blame the disease, not the man. But with that kind of being my focus, I turned to books a lot when I was younger. You know, it was hard to make friends because there was always the embarrassment of, if I come home from middle school one day, because I could walk to my house from where my school was. We were in a small town in Chesapeake, Virginia at that point. And I was going to Olive Branch Elementary School, and it was literally just a 5-minute walk from my front door to the school. But I always worried about that walk on the way home. I didn't want the other kids that were walking with me to know which house was mine, because one time I came home and there were 3 police cars in the front yard because my dad had wandered off during a moment. And I didn't want that to be something that I had to constantly explain. So, you know, a lot of my friends were books, old movies. I would, you know, stay up late. I would stay up late and binge whatever I could that would come in on TV. You know, we didn't have a lot of money at that point. We were living off my dad's 100% disability settlement from the Army and a few part-time jobs that my mom was working at the time using her knowledge of accounting. And we moved around for a bit. And then when the school shooting started in Virginia back in the early 80s, my mom didn't want her kids growing up and having to go to a school where there would be a metal detector every day. And my dad had a sister who was living in Hatteras Island. Parents talked and they're like, well, I mean, it's still 1986 down here. We don't even lock our doors. Like, there's 700 people that live in the village total. You're not going to get much safer than that. Let's see if we can find you a place to stay. And so they found a house that we could afford to rent. And so we took everything and moved from Virginia to Hatteras Island. So I went from, you know, being in a school of 3,000 kids to being in a, you know, class that was not even close to 30. It was a huge drop. They'd all been in class together since kindergarten. So once again, I was the outsider, you know, and fortunately I had developed a mild ability for, you know, art at that point, and it was a stress reliever for me. And the art teacher there at the high school, Marta Langowski, she saw that and kind of took me under her wing and created a number of extracurricular courses available for me all throughout high school that she just started calling different numbers, because I think there wasn't anything after art 2 at that time. So she's just like, all right, we're going to create art 301 and art 302. And we're just going to designate that as this 2-hour block in the afternoon where you can just have free reign of the room and all the supplies. Just make me something I can enter into a contest every now and then to show that we're actually doing some work. And so, you know, that was kind of my safe haven in the school, was that art room for a long time. And I graduated early. I was one of the first people that was one of the first classes in North Carolina that was offered a program they were trying where it would happen your senior year, where you only had to go to school till 1 p.m. and you could choose to either work full time with the rest of the time you had off, or you could choose to take night classes from 6 to 9 at the high school. And that was going to be all of the requirements you would need to qualify for your first freshman year of college. So I actually graduated my freshman year of college and my senior year of high school at the same time, because my job at the time was seasonal. I was working as a lifeguard and there's nothing to do with that in the wintertime. So I took advantage of that and said, well, I'll take the college courses. So when I actually went to Chowan College after my graduation in 95, I was actually entering as a sophomore instead of a freshman. So, which was a little bit of a, it was a little bit of a jump, you know. It was kind of hard to find where I fit in at Chowan, but it was a good college to get some experiences at. I was only there for a year, and then I finished up my degree with ECU via their satellite campus, College of the Albemarle in Manio, North Carolina. And after that, I moved from the island to Raleigh, North Carolina, because at that point, the people I was working with were based out of Raleigh, but I had joined an acting troupe because up until this point, I had also been training for the US Olympics as a fencer. And I'd had an injury when I was 18, where I was run over by a hit and run driver as a pedestrian. So I lost 3 discs out of my back. My left hip has been replaced. My left shoulder has been replaced. My right shoulder doesn't have that much time left in it, but it's hanging in there. And probably both the knees are going to be next all before I'm 50. And the problem is, because the impact from the accident accelerated a genetic condition that we were unaware that I had at the time that sometimes can be sped up due to blunt force trauma called biodegenerative osteoarthritis. So the cartilage, all my joints, everything like that, they deteriorated at a much more rapid rate than others. So I might be 46, but I have the skeletal structure of a 60-year-old, sadly. But I'm still able to be active. I'm still able to, you know, have energy and do what I want. I just have to know what my limitations are. And after that accident, I learned where my limitations were with fencing. And so I actually took that knowledge and started working with a friend of mine that was at Screen Gym Studios in Wilmington that got me my SAF certification, which is the Stage Fighters of America, and also my SAG certification for the Screen Actors Guild. And I started doing extra work as a stage combat artist and stunt fight choreographer. And so this group that I was working with in Raleigh to help make ends meet and just as a form of relaxation and fun, we had a group called the Shadow Players, and we would travel up and down the East Coast, eventually even internationally going into Canada and a few other places in the Keys. And we had a pirate sword fighting comedy skit that we would do, which is like a 30 to 45 minute show that involves some live action sword fighting and a lot of pirate comedy and, you know, interaction with the kids in the crowd. It was a really big hit at a lot of the outdoor festivals up and down the East Coast and different states. We did about 30 to 35 shows a year, every year from about April until about the right about the first week before Thanksgiving. And then we would take the winter off the train, kind of regroup, and then we would do it again next year. And that was my life for a long time, for like almost, God, 20 years. And I also started playing Blackbeard the Pirate as an emissary for the state of North Carolina. I actually even had a short period of time where I was with the Department of Cultural Resources leading the Knights of the Black Flag exhibit that was at the North Carolina Museum of History, where I would come in as Blackbeard dressed up in my full Blackbeard costume and regalia, six pistols, two swords, all of it, and would lead people through a walking tour of the exhibit that was there at the museum. And I was having fun in that life. I really was. I was still constant pain every single day of my life from the numerous injuries that I'd suffered. And cannabis had been something that I'd always leaned on for pain management, inflammation management, things like that. And then 6 years ago, there was a ringing in my left ear that would not stop. And the more they investigated, they found the cause of it was there was a encephaloceal in frontal lobe part of my skull, which is basically a crack that should have healed at birth. But because of continued blunt force trauma, like being in the stage combat and choreography industry for 22 years straight, that crack had become exasperated by how many times I'd gotten hit in the head doing different stunts and different fights and things like that. And it caused a mass of cells to form a growth in the frontal lobe of my brain that very much mimicked the same type of growth you would find with the glioblastoma. Because of its location and its size, they were not able to operate without having to do a full craniotomy. And I asked them how long it would take to recover from that. They said anywhere from about 3 to 6 months. And when I found out that if it was cancer, we're looking at possibly a year to live at best, I didn't want to spend half the time I had left on this planet recovering from a surgery that I didn't need. So I asked them how long I had to wait until there was some type of test that we could do that there was just no question, it's cancer. We know what we need to do. And they said 3 months. They said, if you come back in 3 months for another MRI, you know, obviously sooner if symptoms get worse, but if we give it 3 months, if we do another MRI at that point, if the tumor has grown any in size or has spread at any point, we don't need to biopsy. We'll know at that point that it's cancer. So I took the first of those 3 months to plan all of my own final expenses. I contacted my state attorney, my state family planner, contacted the Secretary of State. I figure out what taxes I may still owe next year. I wanted to make sure that when I left, there was absolutely a zero next to my name when it comes to the overall tally book, so to say. Made sure that my will was updated. And then I bought a one-way ticket to the Key West. And the plan was that in 3 months, if it was what it was going to be, Then I was going to fly out to Key West, where I performed in Mallory Square as a street artist back in the early days of my entertainment career. And that spot in Mallory Square has some of the most beautiful sunsets you'll ever see in your life. And I wanted to watch one last sunset. And then I had a hotel room and I had arrangements with the funeral home there in Key West, where I was going to check into that hotel room and just make sure to take enough pills where I didn't wake up again. And then my remains will be cremated, shipped back to North Carolina, and then my wife and my family knew what to do with them from there. Once all those arrangements were made, I wanted to just enjoy the last 2 months that I had, visiting as many people as I could, as many family members as I could, old friends, you know, try to settle some old grudges, you know, just anything I could to feel better about what would happen if I got the worst news. And then a friend of mine just asked me, he said, you know, you've turned to cannabis for everything else in your life up to this point medically. Have you looked into it in regards to this? And I realized that I've been so overwhelmed with planning for the worst case scenario that I hadn't thought about alternative ways to prevent that day from ever happening. So I started doing my own research and I found an Indonesian scientist that had had some really positive results when it came to brain trauma from head injury, like car accident victims, professional sports athletes that have had concussion after concussion, things like that. So I got a cannabis strain that was as close as the one I could find that they were using based on the little bit of research I could find that he had peer published. And I combined with that a small microdosing procedure of psilocybin, and every other week, 1 to 2 hits of, I'd say, medium grade LSD. So I did that for 2 months straight. It was about an ounce of cannabis every 7 days, about an eighth of magic mushrooms every 7 days, then 1 to 2 hits of acid. And I did that for same time every day, like wake up in the morning, have pre-rolled joints ready to go, you know, have my mushroom snacks throughout the day ready to go. And within the first week, almost all of my symptoms started to subside. My balance came back. My vision wasn't blurry anymore. I wasn't slurring my words. I wasn't having word asphyxia, where I would mix up sentences in my head. No, where the sentences were straight in my head, but when I would say them, they would come out mixed up. I would start forgetting very, very short-term memory things. Almost kind of, I wouldn't call them full blackouts, but there are moments of just complete disconnect from the reality that I was in. And all of that was being caused from the issues, you know, that were going on neurologically. And they just all started to stop. Like almost, it felt almost like overnight. And I just decided, all right, I'm going to keep as many notes as I can. We're going to see how this goes. If it's working so far, why not, you know, what's the point in stopping it? And so I just continued for the rest of the 2 months. And when I went back in for that first MRI 3 months later, they found that the tumor had shrunk by 0.002 centimeters, and they deemed it benign at that point. They said, there's no reason for a biopsy. You know, we need to continue monitoring your side effects and your symptoms. But at this point, you know, we could go up through the nose if we wanted to and kind of blast the remains of it that are there away, similar to what we would do with like a kidney stone. And I just chose to do nothing. And I said, I'm going to keep doing the same procedure that I'm doing. And, you know, if you want to keep checking my vitals, that's fine. And they obviously couldn't condone what I was doing, because the medical group that they worked for still had a very strict stance when it came to cannabis and psychedelics, and still does. So I wasn't able to really be open and honest with my medical providers at that point, but I had to be at the same time. So they knew what I was doing, but they could not in any way approve of it. And, you know, proud to say 6 years later, you know, my microdosing procedure on a daily basis has greatly differed, now that it's not the medical necessity that it was to take care of such a huge life-changing event. But I also don't want to lose the things I've learned that it's given me, the increase in my creativity, the weight management that I've been able to have, just the overall general mental health that I've achieved that's been so much better than it was before I started microdosing. So I decided the day that I found out that this was benign, that if cannabis and psychedelics truly saved my life, that I would dedicate my life to them. And that's when I decided to start North Carolina's first ever consultancy firm for the legalization of cannabis and psychedelics called CIC Consultants. And CIC has always stood for change is coming, which was kind of the mantra that I used with my social media presence still to this day, with the North Carolina flag, with the weed leaf on it, and just different things that I've posted. You know, the hold fast North Carolina, change is coming has just become kind of a battle cry for us to know that, you know, our voice is here. It's not going away, and we're going to continue to do everything we can to be the loudest voice in the room, whether you want to hear it or not, especially when that voice is calling for compassion for those that need it most in our state. And so I started using the notoriety that I had with the media as an, you know, as a local entertainment artist. I started using that relationship for political gain and getting interviews when it came to the topic of cannabis in North Carolina, when we introduced Senate Bill 711 back in 2021. And I managed to give a speech. I managed to speak at every single one of the committees that bill went through. I spent tireless hours in the NCGA. I formed relationships with Republican GOP leaders in that building that would have never talked to me otherwise. But we had a similar similar interest and a similar goal finally, is it was a Republican-backed cannabis bill, something that I never thought that I would see in North Carolina, but I'm glad that it came. And we got it through the Senate, and it passed. And then it went to the House and died a slow death under Tim Moore's watch. And then we couldn't do anything on it in 2022. And then the first bill, one of the first three bills introduced, the first day the NCGA was back, was Senate Bill 3, the North Carolina Compassionate Care Act, which was basically just a carbon copy of Senate Bill 711. And once again, it passed the Senate with flying colors. And now we're right back to where we were before. They've had this bill on the desk in the House since the first week we were back in session, and we are 6 months in. And everything I keep hearing is end of month, you know, the June is going to be when it happens. Just sit back, wait for it. You're going to see massive movement by the end of the month. But they told me that in April as well. So it's, I'm seeing things that are pointing towards us going in that direction, but I don't know how much faith I put in rumors at this point. I'd rather keep moving forward like it's not going to happen at the end of the month, even if I know that it is, so that I don't lose the same passion and same sense of urgency that I've always had when talking about this topic. And I've managed to get Senate Bill 455 passed, which protected the hemp industry in North Carolina. And then even as of yesterday, I got the new House bill to pass that House Representative McNeely wrote, which is the hemp cannabinoid regulation and kratom bill. And I've been working on that bill with him since the beginning. So I've seen success in everything that I've done. But again, it's all been from cannabis and educating as many people as possible and bringing a different light to the topic of cannabis, not just on a local scale, but on a national scale, has always been the main drive and ambition that I've had that's led to any of the successes that I could possibly list if I was putting together a resume. Cannabis has always been there, and my love for cannabis will never die because of that. And it's one of the things that fuels me to keep moving forward, even though there's not really a roadmap to how to be, you know, a self-made lobbyist in a very Southern Republican controlled state when you yourself are not of that political mindset.
That's an amazing journey you walked us through, Chris. I mean, I think you basically told us exactly, what you're passionate about, you know, why you're passionate about it, and, what is it needs to be done to take this next step forward. Any words of any of other advice would you like to share in terms of lobbying per se, or anything in terms of your future as well?
I would say, as far as advice when it comes to lobbying, if there's anyone that's listening to this episode that is thinking of getting into this as a profession or is currently in this profession and is hitting a wall, don't ever surround yourself in this business with people that will tell you no. And what I mean by that is that there is no such thing as a bad idea. If you have an idea that you think will lead to get you to an end result that will benefit the parties you represent, and one of your peers, coworkers, or superiors tells you no, unless it is something that they're saying no because it is a strict violation of the ethics code that we have here in North Carolina, then you need to walk, because there is, at the end of the day, this is conversation, this is negotiation tactics, this is sales, this is psychology of how to deal with another human being. And there is no black and white rule book for that. You have to be able to think outside of the rules without breaking any ethical rules in the same process. But if someone tells you no, then you walk. Don't ever give up on any of your ideas in that regard, because if you believe that it will get you the end result that you want, you're not going to lose anything by trying. But continuing to stay somewhere where you hear no every time you come up with what you feel is a brilliant idea, you'll never be able to get in the mindset that you need to be in of being respected in the position you're in. And then you'll never be able to advance in a career like this. It'll just eat you up from the inside out, because you'll constantly be doubting yourself because you never have that external recognition from those around you.
Well said. Well, I think, Chris, with the words, the eloquently put, and no wonder why the legislators want to listen to you. It's not only the words, but also your voice as well. So thanks so much for being here. You're truly an inspiration.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.